Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. We are here today to discuss the EU's next seven-year multi-annual financial framework, the main budget. And we have the great honor of having Johan van Overtveldt, the chairman of the European Parliament's Budget Committee, to talk to us about how that is going to go. The talks to put this together are going to go. And Zsolt Darvas, who is Bruegel's senior fellow and the lead author of a blueprint that came out last year on various ways to overhaul the budget and ways to make it work better with many Bruegel co-authors. And you can find that in the show notes. Johan, it is such a delight to have you back on the show. And to get us started, tell us about the Parliament's negotiations with the Commission proposal so far. At first, it was not well received. Now, there at least seem to be talks happening, so that's good, but so many points of contention. So tell me where you see the budget.
First of all, thank you very much for having me. As you already outlined, there was a lot of uneasiness, to use a polite word, with the initial proposals of the Commission. There have been a lot of formal and informal contacts with the von der Leyen Commission, with Commissioner Serafin. And of course, these talks will have a long way to go in order to come to concrete proposals. But there is a sense in the Parliament that the Commission realizes that on some aspects, and for example, referring to agricultural policies, there will have to be some changes in the initial proposals in order to get the consent of the Parliament. So it's ongoing. It is clearly quite difficult, quite complex, not least because the agreement, disagreement, or somewhere in between with the initial Commission proposals run through the different political groups in the Parliament. You cannot say that it is group A, B, and C who are in favor, and D and E who are against. It's much more complex than that, which makes it also, for those who have to negotiate, the new MFF makes it more complicated.
So we saw the initial proposal make some pretty radical changes for how funding is spread among the regions, among agriculture and other types of sectors, and also toward Ukraine. Walk us through what are the biggest ambitions of the budget and what you think would be the biggest successes if any of this makes it through.
Well, first of all, let me cool down a little bit the idea that this is a really ambitious and much larger MFF than the one we are finalizing now, or the period is finalized now, because we're talking now in constant prices of a proposal of 1.76 trillion, which is 1.26 of GNI. Now, if you take into account the repayment of the NGEU debt, then you end up with a budget that is practically the same. It's peanuts higher than the budget or the MFF for the period 21-27. I think that's the first important thing to notice in order to temper a little bit the enthusiasm of certain people who think that the spigots of heaven for money would open. That will definitely not be the case. Secondly, there is, if you compare the MFF that is actually running, 21-27, with the proposal of the Commission 28-34, there is basically one big change. And that is that whereas in the 21-27 MFF, cohesion and agriculture represented more or less 66% of the budget, that will be only 54% in the proposals for the new MFF. And almost as a mirror image of that, competition and security increases from 18% of the budget to 30% of the budget. And there, of course, Ukraine is included. That's the biggest change in terms of the change of money, in terms of the content and the way in which to approach the budget. It is, of course, the introduction of the principle of the national and regional partnership plans, where you bring cohesion and agriculture together, which, of course, means that the, how should I say, that the pre-allocated money to cohesion and agriculture becomes less certain. There is much more room to maneuver and to, I'm not going to say play with this money, but to rearrange the direction in which the money go according to the circumstances that occur. And that, of course, can, at this point in time, can only be guessed. So that, I think, would be the major items and major differences for this new proposition of the Commission for the MFF as compared to the now running MFF.
And where do you come down? What do you think should happen?
Well, I think, first of all, we live in a highly uncertain world. Events of recent weeks and months underline that almost every day. So have more flexibility in the budget in order to be able to adjust the spending of money to the needs of the moment or the change in needs more structurally is a good thing. So in terms of addressing money to specific items for specific purposes is a less well policy tool, I think, than it used to be in the past, given the much larger amount of uncertainty. So to a substantial degree, I support this approach, the approach that the Commission utilized in its initial proposal. On the other hand, it has, of course, the danger of somehow or in some way or to some degree renationalizing European policies and making it more specific towards specific national needs. And that's, of course, if you're thinking about further integrating Europe, what we certainly need, given everything happening on the international scene, is, of course, a step backward. And that's something that I think should be thought out a little bit more carefully than it was done initially by the Commission.
Jolt, you have written a lot about European public goods as what the budget really should be for. So can you tell us how the European Union is or is not funding those appropriately right now and what you think should happen?
The EU budget accounts for a very small share of total public spending in the EU, around just 1% of GDP. While if you look at how much national governments spend, they almost spend 50%, half of their GDP. So this means that the EU budget should really focus on spending areas where the EU can bring a value added. And this is nicely summarized, in my view, in the concept of so-called European public goods. The European dimension comes from either because if we do something together, then it's, let's say, more efficient, or there are important cross-border externalities, namely if a country does something, it has an implication on other countries, or if a country doesn't do something, that can also have an implication on other countries. So it's better to coordinate such expenditures together. And also very important is that EU countries should have similar views about such spending items, because even if something is, you know, more efficient to do together, has major cross-border impacts, but EU members completely disagree on how to implement those and what to focus on, then it's better not to do. Now, if you use this concept of European public goods to the current EU budget, then we do find that about half of the EU budget doesn't really correspond to this principle. And one of the biggest portion is agriculture, because about three-quarters of two-thirds of agriculture spending are simply farmer subsidies. This is set in the EU treaty, I have to say. So the EU treaty says that one of the goals of the European Common Agriculture Policy is to support the agricultural community. That's fine. But the EU treaty doesn't say that this should be done or funded at the European level. And clearly, you know, if you give, you know, decoupled payments to farmers, that's not really something which is more efficient to be done together or doesn't involve cross-border externalities. So in my view, I know that neither the Parliament nor the Commission nor EU member state share this view. Farmer subsidies should be financed nationally, but under commonly set rules. So because it shouldn't have differences in how much farmers receive in different countries. So there should be common principles on how much farmers could get. But I don't see really a case for funding that from the scarce European resources. Another major component of the EU budget that doesn't correspond to the public goods is cohesion spending. Cohesion spending is absolutely important. This is one of the heart of the European Union, that it helps poorer regions and poorer countries to converge. But again, if you look through the lens of European public goods, there is very limited cross-border externalities. There is some, for example, if Poland or Czech Republic grows faster, then also Germany, Italy, and other countries trading with those countries benefit. So there are some externalities, but not really a lot. However, compared to, in contrast to agriculture spending, cohesion spending cannot be nationalized, because, you know, the real aim of cohesion spending is that richer regions provide funding for poorer regions. So even though that's not a European public good, we still suggest that it should be done at the European level. But still, we do see that a large or some share of the current EU budget could be refocused. And in fact, in this perspective, I was happy to see the Commission proposal that it aims to reduce the overall share of agriculture and cohesion and increase competitiveness and research funding. So I think this direction is correct. I fully agree that the size of the budget, the proposed budget, is too small. We also had an earlier research in which we looked at how much of the Draghi investment gap, which is about 5% of GDP annually, how much of that should be funded by public and private sources, and within the public sector, what should be the ideal role of the European budget versus national budgets. And we did find that about 0.8% of GDP annual extra spending would be worthwhile by the European Union budget, and we simply don't get that. The budget as a share of GDP just marginally increases, and indeed, if we take away the debt service of NGEU, then essentially there is no increase. So unfortunately, there is no real increase in the proposed budget. There is some reallocation which we welcome. So let's hope that the negotiations will be able to achieve also some increase in the budget size.
Thank you. Coming back to what we heard earlier about agriculture, how do you see the balance between what the budget either is asked to do or by the member states or the commission or the parliament, and then bringing in Ukraine? Because on the one hand, you've got the parliament saying, no, the commission plan on agriculture and the budget is totally unacceptable. We want to move all this around. We have von der Leyen's new proposal. And then if Ukraine does join the EU, of course, they're a big farming country, and that will turn everything upside down. How do we organize all that in our heads?
So first of all, I really hope that Ukraine will be able to implement reforms and improve its governance system, and will be ready for joining the EU in a not too distant future. But even in the best case, I'm afraid this will take time and a couple of years. And if you look back what happened after the 2004 new countries, or the 2007 Bulgaria, Romania, or Croatia in 2013, we do see that the accession treaties included transitional provisions until these countries obtained full access to EU funding, including agriculture funding. And it took about 7 to 10 years for these countries to fully benefit from all EU policies. So if Ukraine would join in some years from now, then most likely, obviously it will depend on political negotiations, could also take another decade until Ukraine would fully benefit from, for example, from the common agriculture policy or for cohesion policy. Another aspect which should not be overlooked is that a new country like Ukraine or Western Balkans joining the EU is, you know, not just a one-way big financial liability for the European Union, that namely the EU budget will spend a lot of money in these countries. But again, if you look at what happened after the 2004 enlargement, it brought lots of then Western European companies into the region, which benefited enormously. You know, they benefited, you know, from the qualified labor, established lots of factories, trades very substantially increased. And that made, you know, these companies much more profitable. It also made these companies to employ more people, not just in the new member states, but even in the old member states. So even the budget of, you know, Germany, Austria, Italy, France, and all other countries, they also directly benefited from enlargement, because their domestic companies, which had more activities in the new members, became more profitable. You know, they paid more taxes, they employed more people. Those people, you know, paid more income taxes. They had more consumption. They paid more consumption taxes. So clearly, looking at in a one way that just the EU would EU budget would spend a lot of money on Ukraine and other new member states is a very one-sided view and doesn't consider the other even direct financial benefit that current new member states would get. So overall, again, my main message is that it would take a long time, until new members could fully benefit, and in the meantime, also, current European companies would financially benefit from such enlargement, and also, therefore, national budgets would also benefit from such enlargements.
Thank you for that. In the second half of this podcast, I'd like to talk more about the politics of all of this. The European Commission put forward their budget proposal in July, and then at the end of October, we saw a letter from many leaders in the parliament saying we reject this as a basis to start negotiations. Later on, after some back and forth, things are moving forward. Johan, you did not sign this letter. How do you see this as a way to get started? It seems like a very confrontational way to go right off the bat.
Well, it's politics, like you said, and let's not forget that we still have some time to go before it's really decision time. And I want to remind everybody that President Costa clearly said some time ago that he would make sure that there is a clear position from the Council by the end of this year of 26. So that means that at the moment we are 1 year into, I'm not going to say a vacuum, that would be wrong, but into a period where things can move in all kinds of direction, all kinds of discussions can take place, will take place, are taking place. But of course, money time is for this year. If and when the Council indeed would agree to a position on the MFF by the end of this year, which according to my humble opinion is also absolutely not sure that it will happen. But anyway, so there's a lot of uncertainty. And also like Zolte already indicated, once you start thinking about what might come into the political discussions, then of course Ukraine takes a very central position. If we would start talking about Ukraine joining the EU, that would implicitly mean or explicitly that the war is over, because we are not going to take into the EU a country in war. That means that a lot of money going to Ukraine at the moment through all kinds of direct and indirect channels would also be at least partially be available again to make use of in other directions than what is actually in the war situation happening. So this is a very volatile position depending on what's happening on the war peace front. A very interesting comment from Zolt was on the private investment that took place after further enlargements. I'm a little bit more, how should I say, concerned with respect to Ukraine, because however these peace negotiations turn out or come to a final stage, there will also be a lot more uncertainty about what can happen to Ukraine in the coming decade. It's a fact of life. What has happened, cannot be erased. So I think that there is somewhat more hesitancy on the part of private investors to immediately step in and do what they did in countries like Romania or Poland or other countries when they accessed the EU. So I think also with respect to that, there would be more uncertainty. If I may, on Zolt's argument on the European public goods, as an economist, I totally agree with what he has been saying and how he has been specifying that. On the politics, because now you wanted to talk politics, of course, the desirable redirection of the way in which agricultural support policy is executed is out of the question. I think we all know that. I'm not going to name names, but there are a few large countries who are benefiting very much from the present situation, and it would really be over my dead body or over our dead body to change that at the moment. I regret that, certainly as a chairman of the budget committee, but like I said, and as an economist, I would immediately go full force in the direction outlined by Zolt. But as a politician, I have to admit that this is really impossible. This would really blow up every negotiation.
So what do we do instead?
Well, we try to muddle through, like the EU and EU-related institutions always do. My own expectation is that the concept of these national and regional partnership plans will basically remain intact, but that the allocation of money within that broader context will be more restrictive than it is actually, so that the degree of flexibility that the Commission wanted to gain will certainly diminish in the final stages of or the ultimate negotiation on where the MFF will land.
What about innovation? The Commission proposal seeks to merge a lot of the individual earmarked funds for different types of innovation projects in the hope that this money can be put to use as opposed to being kept in little pots that then get raided for others' senses and you know, jumbled up the way it has in recent years. Do you think that this is viable to merge a bunch of these? Or do you think that keeping the funds separate is one way that the legislators have to ask for some sort of accountability, because if changes want to be made, they do have to come and ask for it?
Well, where there are economies of scale, where you can relatively increase the output as compared to the output that now occurs given the segmentation of the use of funds, then we certainly should do that. I think my contacts with the private sector tell me that the Horizon program works quite well. There is a lot of satisfaction in the way in which they approach things and in the way in which they follow up on things. So let's not reinvent the warm water and let's strengthen the Horizon program by bringing in the sources of other funds or other mechanisms that exist. So I think we really should stop multiplying all these kinds of mechanisms and institutions and you name it, and focus on those that function well and enlarge their possibilities. I know that's quite basic, but I think it's time to start thinking about some basic things. And by the way, in terms of certainly basic research, due to the economies of scale that Europe can offer, this is exactly where we have to put our money if, for the longer run, we want to regain a competitive position that should be ours and that we lost to some degree in the, let's say, past two decades.
Thank you. Jean, we've talked a little bit already about the member states, who, of course, are the other co-legislators in this process. Can you tell us how you see divisions among the countries evolving, and do you think they'll be able to get a negotiating position by the end of the year?
Well, I'm not a political predictor, if I can say that way. But if you look at how budget negotiations in the earlier 7-year rounds evolved, then ultimately EU countries were able to agree on a common position. But unfortunately, more often than not, this common position involved only relatively limited changes to the status quo. Now, the big question now is that also Johan mentioned is that the Commission wants to have these national and regional partnership plans, which gives EU members a large degree of flexibility on how they wish to spend EU money. And, you know, some EU countries are very happy about it because they feel that they will have more freedom. And this is what, in fact, the Commission wanted, because they wanted to have a kind of greater ownership. So if countries could have a larger role in designing, you know, whether to, you know, spend more on cohesion or on security or other aspects which are included, including agriculture in the national and regional partnership plans, then indeed there could be some greater degree of national ownership. So the main question to me is how member states will agree on the two big projects. As also Johan mentioned, our proposal for agriculture will not even put on the table. In fact, a number of countries also seeing the protests of farmers in capitals, they are aiming to protect as much as possible from farmer subsidies. So in my view, the big question for the 27 countries to come into a consensus view is how much they want to, you know, bring back, let's say, agriculture and cohesion, and, you know, what they are ready to sacrifice, because at the same time, net payer countries don't want to increase the overall size of the budget. So if they want to increase agriculture and cohesion spending compared to the Commission proposal, it means that something else should go down. And obviously what could go down is the external action fund. Again, if I look back 7 years, we looked at what the Commission proposed for external action 7 years ago, and it was very substantially cut back by the final agreement, which would be, I think, unfortunate, because I do think that the EU, as one of the richest area in the world, has major roles in supporting least developed countries elsewhere. And the other item which could be cut is obviously all the second pillar, all the competitiveness or possibly the defense spending. So I'm afraid, as an economist, I wouldn't advise cutting any of these three items, but my expectations is that unfortunately some of them, or perhaps all of them, would be cut back somewhat.
Johan, what's your sense of defense in particular, the defense debate? Because EU spending on anything defense has been such a hot topic lately, and yet we're also hearing that politically it's something that is the most sort of add on to the budget and might have to go in favor of these traditional priorities. What do you think?
Well, with respect to defense, there would already be a huge step forward for the European scene if we would have much more streamlining of procurement positions of the different countries. That would already help a lot. When I talk to defense people, to NATO people, that would really be a major step forward. And by the way, you don't need to spend money for that. That's a question of sitting together and coming together on the rules and the regulations that determine the way in which material is procured. By the way, when you talk about European public goods, there's a lot of things you can do without spending money. The capital markets unions, reinforcing the internal market, deregulation are all things that can be done. I'm not a blind fan of deregulation, but some things should be more deregulated. All these things can be done without spending money. And of course, stimulating economic growth, which would give us more resources to other things. That's by the sideline. But with respect to military, I think if you know how proud certain countries are with their own defense capabilities, it's hard to imagine that even under the present circumstances, they would agree to really a major breakthrough in terms of defense initiatives at the European level. I'm not even talking about the European army, but other breakthroughs in terms of investment infrastructure. So I don't expect big things there, despite the urgency of the international situation. And in this sense, I think this conclusion of mine is a little bit in line with what Zolt said on the probable outcome. My adagium, not my own adagium, but the adagium I often use when I talk about these things is we will end up with a situation: don't rock the boat, which means that you basically, in terms of the large amounts, you stay in the positions that you have actually in the current MFF. And of course, there will be some shuffling around with the External Action Service, maybe losing some money, Frontex gaining some money, Europol maybe also, but not in terms of, okay, we're going to change fundamentally the structure of the budget, the way in which the money is allocated. I don't expect that. And the closer we get to the deadline to an agreement, the more pressure will be to don't rock the boat.
What are the next steps on your side? Are you going to hold a bunch of hearings? You have a bunch of meetings with your colleagues. How do you put together the Parliament proposal this year?
Well, it's still a green week in the European Parliament, as you guys certainly know. So next week we will have a budget meeting. There will be a coordinators meeting of the budget committee too. So I think there will be some first discussions on how to go further. We will certainly also consult with the two rapporteurs, the MFF, which we have been working very closely over the past months. And so what then specifically the agenda will be from here to, let's say, the summer recess, it's not hard to predict in terms of what we will be discussing. It's very hard to predict in which way that will go and what would then be the outcome of that discussion, which I think would still have to wait for the second part of this year and not the first part.
What else should we and listeners be thinking about that we haven't discussed so far? What would you like us to take away?
If I may, I would like to come back to the whole Ukraine financing idea, where, as you remember, I think, Rebecca, you were there, where I was one of the first to say, well, this Euroclear money, we should be able to use that. But you remember, as a collateral, I never talked about taking the money. I think what has now been agreed upon goes in that direction, because basically you don't use the money as collateral, but you use the budget as collateral and you keep the money just frozen. Now, my analysis with respect to Ukraine starts from the fact that if Russia loses the support of China tomorrow, the war will be over in 6 months. That's my first point of analysis. Second point, you cannot keep on claiming that there is a level playing field in terms of competition between China and EU countries or EU companies. I am absolutely a free trader, but free trade supposes that you follow certain rules, which the Chinese have not been doing. Building up their industry behind a protectionist wall, realizing enormous economies of scale, then starting to export on the basis of the cost advantages of these economies of scale. And then along the road, also keeping your currency clearly undervalued. I think the estimates of the under-evaluation of the renminbi run between 10 and 20%. And that's not fair. So what I suggest to do is we import something like $550 billion a year from China. We put an import tariff of 10% on that. That gives you $55 billion, and there you have the money to finance the extra money you need for Ukraine. And you send a message to China that we really don't appreciate that they are so much in support of Putin's regime.
You were, and we had a great conversation on the podcast about it. One of the very first public officials I can remember talking about using the Ukraine money as collateral. And the way I thought about it then, more controversially, also keeping some of it for reparations. Now, we had a proposal with guarantees to bring in the collateral, but your compatriot and fellow party member Bart De Wever was the loudest voice against it. Do you think that tensions might cool down over the next year and we might try again with this as the funding needs grow?
My expectation is if we don't do anything else, and for example, something like I just outlined, then we will have the Euroclear discussion again within less than 2 years' time, because what has actually been foreseen as financing for Ukraine runs for 2 years. And so we will have to start a discussion under the hypothesis that the war will continue in one way or the other, which is unfortunately my expectation. I don't believe Mr. Putin wants peace, but okay, that's a whole other discussion. Then we will have the same kinds of discussion again, say, in the second part of next year. And in order to avoid that, I think we should be thinking more strategically about what we can do to finance Ukraine or to help finance Ukraine in a structural way. And I'm, to be clear, I'm totally in favor of full support for Ukraine in this situation.
Do you have any predictions on what Belgium would support in the next round of this?
Well, let's say that I already briefly discussed the idea with my prime minister and, as you say, former chairman of my party, and he found it an interesting idea.
Thank you so much. We have had such an honor of having Johan van Overtveld, chairman of the European Parliament Budget Committee, on our show today. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
Joel, what would you think would be the path forward on Ukraine? Is the MFF the place? Should there be talks happening outside the MFF that could add more money on top of the pots of money we've been discussing here?
So the EU has so far provided very substantial support to Ukraine, partly via the so-called macro-financial assistance, then created this Ukraine facility with 50 billion euros. Now there is this new loan. Clearly, Ukraine would not be able to finance itself financially without European Union support, not least because the United States under President Trump is gradually withdrawing its support. And the key issue is indeed when and how there will be a ceasefire and then later a peace agreement. You know, it's very difficult to predict. Obviously, I'm not a military expert. Now, if I read the writings of my colleague, Marek Dabrowski, who has just recently published a working paper on the Russian economy, he argues that even though Russia was able to withstand the first 4 years of the war, but this war economy is getting more and more problems, limits production for other purposes than military, drains, you know, human resources. I mean, lots of people fled the country, lots of people died. Financially, still, Russia has some reserves, but that's gradually depleting. So he suggested that gradually Russian financial power will weaken and weaken, and that, you know, that would provide greater incentives. Also, if you look at the data, you know, we, for example, saw that in the second half of last year, there was a decline in Russia's import of consumer products from China, signaling that housing purchasing power is indeed weakening, inflation is higher. So again, I can't really predict, but what could be foreseeable for me is that as the Russia's economy is weakening and domestic fiscal pressures will getting more and more significant, perhaps the likelihood of a ceasefire and then later a peace talk would be more likely. Now, indeed, Johan was absolutely right that we can't speak about EU enlargement until a stable peace agreement is reached. Also, within the peace agreement, there are major issues on what kind of security guarantees Ukraine could receive. Now, Mr. Zelensky already announced that he would give up his demand for NATO membership in exchange for other types of security guarantees. Presumably that could be agreed with the US involvement. Now, once that is made, you know, a peace is agreed, the big question is indeed what kind of repatriation Russia would be made. Will it be included in the peace agreement? Will those close to 200 billion euros which are held in the European Union can be used, for example, to support Ukraine? I think these are the first and foremost fundamental questions. But, you know, foreseeing what additional help the EU can provide to Ukraine is, you know, can't really addressed until we know how the war will end and under what conditions.
How do you see the budget talks proceeding over the next year? It's so much to get our head around. We've covered so much in this podcast. Can you just help us put it all together on the way out?
by witnessing previous budget talks in the previous to multi-annual financial framework, the final agreements were always reached very close to the last minute, meaning in December of the year before the new budget starts. So we still have some time in this respect. As Johan said, the Council of the 27 EU member states plan to have a joint position by the end of this year, which means, you know, a lot of time. And then we will have 2027 for the final round of negotiations. So my expectations indeed is that 2027 will be the most intensive part. My fear, I have to say, is that in the final compromises, there will be a strong forces to move the proposal closer to the current budget, both in terms of allocation across priorities, also across countries. Also, the Commission, for example, I think very wisely proposed the elimination of all kind of rebates. As our listeners might know, there are a number of EU countries, Germany, Netherlands, Sweden, Austria, which countries benefit with so-called budgetary adjustments, which is a very unclear and untransparent mechanism. And the Commission proposed eliminate all of them. But as we hear, you know, these countries seem to insist that they must be reinstated. So again, I would expect that this will be one of the positions of the European Council, that they want to keep those rebates. A number of countries want to keep agriculture subsidies, so probably that will increase compared to the Commission proposal. The group of cohesion or the friends of cohesion wants to keep cohesion funding intact. So my fear is that in the final negotiations, the agreement will imply less changes than what the Commission proposed. And I think this would be unfortunate, because this time indeed the Commission really proposed, I think, very substantial changes, and many of them go to the right direction.
Thanks very much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics. We recorded this on Thursday, January 8th, with Johan van Overtveldt and Bruegel Senior Fellow Zsolt Darvas. You can find Zsolt's report and links to our prior discussions about Ukraine and other related research in the show notes for this show. Our website is Bruegel.org, I should say, and all of these things are available free to download. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time.